That thing about caring people, how did you get to ask somebody that you care about, respect, and has something that you want to come tell their story? And our speaker tonight is one of those guys. Listening to him share, you think he'd been around decades in this field. Because he gets this field. He wants it. And he works and shows. Shows him the way he talks with people after the meeting. I've watched it. Anytime somebody needs to visit with you, you're right there. When you share in the meetings, it always touches me. It's always from the heart. And I asked you to speak because I want to get you to know you better. I want to hear more of your story. I want to know how you got here and what's keeping you here. So without any further ado, here's Sam.
Thank you, Dave. First of all, I want to thank y'all for having me here to speak tonight. It's an honor. And I want to apologize because I'm kind of down under the weather a little bit. And I'll probably be coughing a lot and sniffling. I'll do the best I can. I'm Sam. I'm alcoholic. You know, I want to say that I grew up around here, but that'd be a lie because I don't think I've ever really grown up. But I moved to Whitney from Fort Worth, and my parents moved down here because I was getting involved with the wrong kind of people and doing the wrong things. And I was in elementary school, and I was probably already an alcoholic by the time I was 12 years old, and I smoked pot, and they thought moving out to the country would make that a little more difficult for me to do. Well, they weren't exactly right. It was actually just the opposite. It was much easier to get involved in that crowd in the country than it was in the city. Of course, I would have found it anywhere I was persistent, you know. I was a really weird little kid. Now I'm just a really weird adult. I remember in the third grade, we had a show and tell, and we always had that on Fridays or something, you know. And as this particular show and tell, everybody got up and told the class what they wanted to be when they grew up. You know, it's like third or fourth grade. You know, they started sending me to counseling and all kinds of stuff because I got up there and when I talked to the class, I told them I wanted to be crazy and go to a nut house and I wanted to be a hobo. And I was dead serious, you know. I watched them old hobo movies and they sit around the railroad tracks drinking and sitting by the fire. I thought, man, that's the life. You ain't got to worry about nothing. Well, I succeeded in half of that anyway. I became a good hobo. And anyway, I moved down here and I played football. And in Whitney, you didn't drink and smoke weed and play football. That just didn't happen. It never happened before. And they figured it probably didn't need to happen then either. And luckily I had a girlfriend that was real tough. And she took up for me, because the jocks always wanted to beat me up. But I had a tough girlfriend that would stop them. She'd chase them around with a baseball bat and stuff. But, you know, there's somebody in this group that I grew up with, literally. She was friends of my little sisters. I got two little sisters. And I knew her back then, and we both changed a lot since then, let me tell you. I got to where I didn't participate in school. I skipped school, and subsequently I failed. You know, I remember in the 11th grade I had three English classes a day. I had English 1, English 2, and English 3, and I hated English, and that wasn't going to work. So, came to school one morning, which was rare. because I never was there in the morning. And I just threw my books in the locker and I just walked out. And hitchhiked back to Fort Worth. And then that was started my homeless career. And I guess, how old would I have been? 16, 17, something like that. And I took off. And went to Fort Worth, and I could never get it together there. I lived in the attic of a, or I lived up in the ceiling of a washateria for a couple months. Put some plywood up there so I could lay down. Nobody knew I was in there. Climb on top of the dryer and climb up in the ceiling. And I lived like that for a couple months. And I got tired of that because it was kind of hot up there anyway. And I took off to my grandma's house in New Mexico. And I was just as wild as I could be. And I got involved with some people there. And it's pretty much the norm to drink and use drugs in New Mexico for kids, everybody. You know, it's real common there. And I got wrapped up pretty good in that stuff and got involved with a band and went out to California to get rich playing music. And we weren't very good. We only got a couple of gigs and we were fired. And everybody left but me. And I stayed with this guy that said he was going to manage us. And stayed up in the mountains in California. And he had a new business offer for me. And I was real heavy alcoholic, you know. And I needed a business opportunity to support my alcoholism. And this was manufacturing a controlled substance. And man, it really got bad then. I got real spun out into that stuff real bad for a couple of years. And then the aliens were chasing me, so I went to Hawaii. Took off to Hawaii. I called my brother. I said, man, I can't stay in California anymore. He said, why? Because everybody's after me. He says, all right. He says, I'll send you a plane ticket. He sent me a plane ticket, and I went to Hawaii. Well, talk about jumping out of the frying pan into the fire. Hawaii is way worse than California or New Mexico put together. And this was on the Big Island of Hawaii. And my brother was he cut grass for a living, we'll just say that. You know. He made about $200,000 a year, so you know, that was a pretty good deal for me. And I sit around in his house for 3 months and I was cutting grass. And made a lot of money. And I got real wild too. It's in the jungle on the volcano, and there's no running water, there's no electricity, you know, no TV, nothing like that. And it's pretty much basic living. And I got real wild, but I stayed in Hawaii for 9 years, or no, 11 years, I'm sorry. I was there actually 11 years. And I just got wilder and wilder, and you know, I was living in tea shacks up on the volcano and tending my harvest, you know, and just getting wilder and wilder and wilder. And then I got, see, they call this rock fever in Hawaii. If you stay there too long on one island, you get what they call rock fever. And I started having really bad dreams. And dreams of tidal waves coming, tsunamis coming and washing me out to sea and drowning me. And dreams of the volcano going off and covering me with hot lava. You know, really bad nightmares like that. And earthquakes just opening up. And you know, and this stuff really happens there all the time. You know, it really, really does. And I got real paranoid, and I had to come back. So I came back and I was wild. I mean, this is in 94. I came back is when I came back. I went there in 83 and came back in 94. But while I was in Hawaii, I got my first taste of Alcoholics Anonymous. My friend said, come on, you're going to an AA meeting with me. And I said, no, I'm not. He said, oh, yeah, you are. He said, I want to go over it by myself. And he said, you need it anyway. I said, oh, I don't need it. He said, well, I'll buy you some beer after the meeting if you'll go up there with me. I said, okay, I'll go. So that was my introduction to AA. I had no desire to go or anything or participate at all or anything. And I went into that meeting, and, man, I was, you know, I was a wild kid, and I talked too much, and I said things that I ought not to say, and I said a whole lot of things in that meeting that I shouldn't have said, that I regret now, you know. Now that I know more about it, I really regret the way I acted in that meeting. I basically told them, you know, y'all pitiful creatures ought to just stick a gun in your mouth and pull the trigger. That's what I thought, you know, and that's the way I felt. And I let them know it too. And then I came back from Hawaii and I started getting in trouble. I moved to California, to San Diego. Well, I started in LA. And I was like an animal. I was so crazy and wild, because in Hawaii the cops don't arrest you. You don't get arrested. They don't pursue any laws, you know. I mean, unless it's for murder, and then people that are hunted for that have, you know how we have neighborhood watch programs here? Well, they've got neighborhood watch programs too, except it's on the other side of the fence. It's the outlaws watching the neighborhood for the cops and the other people coming in. And there's a network, and they call it the Coconut Wireless. And everybody is informed of what's going on in the neighborhood, so there's no way the cops can catch anybody. You know, they're gone before they ever even get there. And there's a lot of outlaws that live there on that big island up by the volcano area and stuff. And that's just the way it is there, you know. And so when I went to San Diego, man, I was in trouble every time I turned around. And I knew I had a problem, and I just couldn't stop. They would catch me, and I'd get thrown in jail for 90 days, and that was a great vacation. But as soon as I got out, I was back into the same thing again. And this happened over and over and over and over. Finally, they got tired of that, and they said, well, Mr. Lamson, we're going to give you a life sentence. And see, I didn't even know this. I had no earthly idea that I went to court and got a life sentence. It was just one day I was in prison, and I looked up and I was in prison. Because, you know, it took me a few months for my brain to come back to reality. You know, and I looked up one day and I was in the penitentiary, and one of the guys was saying, hey, how much time did you get? And I'm like, I had no earthly idea. He said, well, they gave you a little piece of paper. You went before the parole board. He said, go look at that little pink piece of paper and see how much time's on it. And I went and looked through my locker, and sure enough, there's a little piece of paper in there. And it said 20 to life. And I just came apart. I did that foxhole prayer. God, help me out of this, and I'll do anything. I'll stop drinking. But, you know, I really, really meant it. But I was so far gone that that didn't take effect till long afterwards. But that was when I finally surrendered to God, and I said, I can't do this. You got to help me. And then, you know, I was crying and everything. And then come to find out in California, you get 20 years and you only do a quarter of it if it's not a violent crime. So I got out in like 5.5 years, you know. Wasn't that bad. But when I did, I got to the sidewalk in the parking lot, through the gate, and there was a van sitting there. and it was interstate transport. And as soon as I walked, I was all happy I finally got out of prison. As soon as I walked up, they said, "Oh, Mr. Lamson, this is your ride right here." They threw me in this van with shackles on, and they took me back to Fort Worth via Tampa Bay, Florida. And I mean, it took like 2 weeks to get me back. No, they took me back to Hillsborough, that's right. And I had warrants in Hillsborough, and so I went to SAP. They sent me to SAP, and I did all that. And, you know, I was really rough. I had been in a gang unit in Los Angeles, and they have levels there, and it was a level 3 gang unit. And you're always under guard with rifles. They always have a rifle pointed at you everywhere you go, even when you're asleep. They got a rifle pointed at you. And then they send me to Texas to save Pete. And now here all the inmates are snitching on each other. And I'm like, oh, no. You know, this ain't going to work. I just came out of one of the roughest penitentiaries in the state for this place where all the inmates snitch on each other. And I hated it. And man, did I get some treatment. I had 23 learning experiences. And LEs are bad. They're like, you got to scrub a toilet for 2 or 3 hours with a toothbrush when you get one LE. I had 23 of those. So I was like scrubbing a toilet 10 hours a day with a toothbrush, you know. And I'd have to flush the toilet, and I'd say, there goes my program. Every 5 minutes, I'd have to flush the toilet. There goes my program. And it was really frustrating. It was tough, to say the least. And I didn't feel like I got anything out of it, not at the time. But later on, it sunk in. And I didn't make it that time either. I made it through the 2 years of the aftercare program. Then I went and relapsed again. And I really tried. And what triggered me was is that I broke my arm at work. And I was doing real good. I had a couple of years. You know, and the doctor started giving me pain pills, and they gave me 60 Lortabs a week. And I had a real bad break in my wrist. It was bone contusions and all kinds of stuff. It was really pretty bad. And man, I got strung out again, you know, on those pain pills, and I relapsed, and started doing heavier stuff. I went back to the penitentiary for the heavier stuff. And when I went before the judge in Hillsborough, he said, "Mr. Lamson," he says, "you know, you've got too many felonies." He said, I should not give you this 10 years. It is the maximum sentence for your crime. He said, I should give you an enhancement, and I should give you a life sentence, and I should give you an habitual, because you are an habitual criminal, and you're a detriment to society." And man, you know, I just fell apart again. You know, and then I remembered back then, I thought, man, God, you know, what's going on? I don't want to spend the rest of my life in the penitentiary. He said, I'll give you this 10 years. He said, but next time you go to court anywhere for anything, so you're going to get a life sentence with an habitual and enhancement. Well, that means they enhance it to a second degree. They make it aggravated so that you have to do over half of your time. And 25 to life, you know, 12 and a half years is that right there at least. And then the habitual is a 5 year. So, you know, I would have done almost 20-something years in the penitentiary. And I said that foxhole prayer again. I said, God, I can't do this, you know. I'm 50 years old, and 25 more years, I'm going to be 75 years old before I get out of the penitentiary. And I hadn't done anything, you know, I haven't done anything with my life that is responsible, you know, nothing at all. And it scared me really bad. So the whole time I was locked up, all I could think about was how I was going to kill myself when I got out. Because I couldn't stay sober. And if I didn't stay sober, I was going to get in trouble again. And when I got in trouble, I was going to do a life sentence. And I just couldn't do that. Just couldn't do it. You know, it was not an option. And so when I got out this time, which was a little over 3.5 years ago now, I was ordered to go to a bunch of AA meetings, and I figured I better go, because if I don't go to AA meetings and they revoke my parole, I'll get a life sentence anyway, you know, and that would be pretty stupid just for not going to an AA meeting. And I'd been to AA before, and I knew AA wasn't going to work for me, you know, it just wasn't going to work. But when I walked in the doors of AA, I was real hopeless. And I was mad, madder than a firecracker, man. I sat in the back of the room with my arms crossed, and I wouldn't say nothing. And if I did, it wasn't nothing nice. I was a very angry person. And in fact, this was the second group that I came to, was here in Meridian. I went to Whitney once, and then I came over here and tried this one. I wanted to see what, you know, look around and see what they were like around here. And man, I don't know what happened, but I heard some really good stuff. And I wouldn't share or anything. I just sat here with my mouth shut. And then I was at a... I went to... About 6 months after I'd been sober, I went to a gratitude meeting in Whitney. And I was going to share. I didn't participate or anything, but I knew that something was happening to me, because when I left the meetings, I felt better than I did when I went in. And I don't know how, because I wasn't listening, and I didn't care, you know. And all I was trying to do was get together a couple $100 so I could get enough stuff to, you know, kill myself with, because I wasn't going back to the penitentiary. And I was at this gratitude meeting, and I was thinking, you know, I know I'm feeling better because I'm singing to the radio on the way home after the meeting. So I must be feeling better. You know, I noticed that. I caught myself. I had to laugh because I hadn't laughed about anything, you know, for a long time. I was very, very angry. And then I was one of the last people in the room to share, and it was coming around my turn. It was a few people down. And I'm trying to think of something I'm grateful for, you know, and I'm really racking my head, because I'm going to speak this time, you know. And nobody was not speaking, so I knew I was going to have to say something, or I should say something. And I thought, you know what, Sam, you had a good day today. You hadn't fought with nobody. Nobody's mad at you. You hadn't made nobody mad. You just had a good day, you know. And I never had a good day in my whole life where I wasn't fighting with somebody or making somebody mad or somebody making me mad. I thought, that's what I'll say then. And then it come a little bit closer, and I was still thinking, you know, and it's going through my head, I'm not listening to nobody, I'm just trying to think what I'm going to say. And it gets a little closer, and all of a sudden it came across my mind again, you know what, you had a good day yesterday too. You didn't fight with anybody yesterday either. I'm like, wow. You know, you're not mad at anybody either. I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. I got 2 days in a row. And then it came up to my turn, and right before my turn, I realized I had 3 good days in a row. And I was excited, man. I mean, I couldn't wait for this person to get through talking so I could tell everybody, you know? And I don't know if that's a spiritual experience or what, but I really felt good for that moment. That's the first time in years that I had felt good about anything. And I felt good. And I mean, just bubbling over good, you know, just, man, I just couldn't wait. And now they can't shut me up, you know. I can tell you, I could talk to y'all for 2 hours, you know, no problem. I could tell you how happy I am today. And that was the start. That was the start of my real recovery. I got so excited. I read the book. I read every piece of literature I could get my hands on. I was like, wow, this stuff is working. And I thought, you know, this works a bit. And it worked so good without no effort at all, I thought, well, maybe I'll put a little effort into it and see what happens then. And I did that. I started listening, and I started trying out these things these people were talking about in my life and seeing how that worked for me, you know? And I was doing that, and it started working, you know? And I had this sponsor. Not sure if I'm supposed to say his name, but his name's Ed. But he's a little rough around the edges. But I'll tell you what, that's exactly what I needed. I needed somebody that wasn't going to pull any punches with me. That was going to tell me exactly where I was messing up, where I was off track. And Ed did. That's exactly what he did. I would catch him on his lunch break, and I'd go on for an hour while he was eating lunch, telling him all the things that the world's doing to me. And then I'd say, well, what do you think about all that? And he'd look up at me and he'd say, you're really full of yourself, aren't you? And man, I got mad. I wouldn't talk to him for like 3 or 4 days, you know. I wouldn't call him. No, I was mad at him, man. How dare him say something like that to me, you know. And it started sinking in. You know, it took a while at first. I was real thick-headed. I'm still real thick-headed. Takes me a while to get stuff sometimes, you know. And it started sinking in. And the more I tried this stuff, the better it worked. The more I tried it, the more it worked. The more it worked, the more I had the courage to try it. And it just kind of compounded like that in my life, you know. I was hopeless. I had to do something. Something had to work. And you know, I thought it was brainwashing. And sure enough, it was brainwashing. But my brain needed to be washed, you know, really bad. And it's not a bad brainwashing. It's a good brainwashing. And I started getting better. And I'm still getting better every day. I'm happy. I'm happy now. I'm not angry about anything. And I've learned that when what I've, one of the things that I've learned in this program is that when adversity comes my way, if everything is exactly the way God it's supposed to be in God's world, and I've given my life and care over to God as I understand Him, then when adversity does come my way, and I get to be a part of God's lesson to somebody else for them to learn something that's good for them, then that's a blessing. And you know, my anger started going away. It just went away. And you know, they also told me that, you know, that person, what I realized through doing the steps is that when I got into the fourth step, I realized that, you know what, that Sam that I was writing about that was on that paper is not the real Sam. That's not what I want to be in my heart. I just didn't know any other way. And when I realized that, I learned to forgive myself a little bit for some of the stuff I did. And I was just eating up with guilt, you know. There was no hope for me. I was so guilty. And when I realized that, and I learned to forgive myself a little bit, I learned to forgive others. And when somebody did something to me, I just know that, hey, that's not the way they really want to be. They're just sick like I was. And it takes all the sting out of it. You know, it doesn't hurt me anymore. Well, it sometimes, you know, I feel it, but it doesn't hurt me bad where I'm going to go drink over it or anything anymore. It takes all the sting out of it, you know. And I can feel sorry, and I can understand, and I can do my best to help that person. And, you know, I love them even though I don't like some of the things they do, you know. And you know, that's become my program. And I don't want to, you know, it's against every fiber of my being to be nice to somebody that's talking junk about me or whatever, you know? Accusing me of something that I'm probably doing anyway, you know? But I have to really check myself, because, you know, I'm self-centered and I'm egotistical and I'm self-righteous. And, you know, all that's natural. It's not natural for me to treat somebody with love and concern and kindness and try to be a real help to them. You know, it's just not natural for me. And I have to really, really watch what I do and what I say. And it's working for me. You know, I come to realize that my problem wasn't drinking and drugs. That wasn't my problem. My problem was Sam. Sam was always feeling sorry for Sam, because Sam couldn't think about nothing but Sam. And what Sam's money and Sam's drugs and Sam's alcohol, that's all Sam ever cared about. If I ever talked to anybody else, it was because I had my own selfish underlying intentions. You know, everything I said and everything I did had selfish underlying intentions. And I was just ate up with guilt for that. You know, I did everything I could to put on that facade that I wasn't like that. But deep down inside, I knew I was. And that guilt was killing me. And it was keeping me out there. And it was, almost got me a life in penitentiary. And thank God for AA that I learned what I learned about myself in this program. To be able to act like a Sam that I kind of respect and I kind of like, and not a Sam that I feel guilty about everything they say and do. And that makes me feel better deep down inside. It heals that wound a little bit. And it makes me feel good enough that I don't have to go out and use drugs and drink to change the way I feel anymore. I can change the way I feel by being a different person. And it's the person I really want to be. You know, not the person that my selfishness tells me that, you know, I got to get my way, but a person that wants to be helpful to others, you know. I was on step 11 in sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will and the power to carry that out. And I got to looking at that step, and that word "only" just jumped out to me. And I thought, I got it, you know? Instead of asking God for cars and ranches and trucks and motorcycles and all this stuff that I always pray to God for, I'm going to ask Him what I can do for Him instead of what He can do for me. And I thought, man, that's going to be cool, you know? And I didn't know anything about meditation. I had no earthly idea. I just heard somebody say that prayer and meditation was praying is asking God a question, and meditation is waiting on the answer. And I thought, you know, I can kind of understand that. I can relate to that a little bit. I think I'll try that, you know? So I prayed to God. I got all ready, you know, and I read the Bible, you know, and I read the big book some, and I was like in my room by myself and had my legs crossed and my hands like this. I thought I was going to float around, you know, when I did this, because I was being so spiritual. And I was ready to wait, too. I was going to wait for that answer, what God wanted me to do. And I was positive that He was going to have me like Joel Osteen with a big football coliseum of people, and I was going to save 1,000 souls a day. You know, I was just sure. Or I was going to go down to Peru, and I was going to save all those Andeans, and I was going to turn them all into Christians, and the whole world was going to be glad for it. You know, man, was I so wrong. I asked God, I said, God, what can I do for you today? And the answer came just like that. It came just like that, and it was real simple. It was one word. He said, everything. And it just floored me. I mean, I was like, whoa, I wish I wouldn't ask that, you know. Maybe I should think another way to put it. You know, maybe I'll get a different answer. But it was just as clear in my head as me talking to you right now. Everything. And I started backpedaling. I ain't going to lie to you. I was like, well, do I got to, can I give this up? And, you know, I was like questioning it. And I just finally calmed down a little bit. And I said, well, I will try my best. And that's all he ever wanted. He didn't want all these big things out of me. He just wanted me to try. He just wanted me to want to. That's all. You know, we're not going to be perfect, but we can have a perfect attitude. And that perfect attitude is just having a little bit of desire to live in God's will. Doesn't mean we're going to be perfect, but we can have a perfect attitude. And this is some of the things that were coming across to me. I don't know if God was talking to me or what. I don't know about all that, but I know that these things were coming across my mind. And one of them was to just, there was a lot of things that I was already doing that were in God's will, that He approved of. I was already pretty nice to other people, and I, you know, there were some things, there were some good things about me. And it just came to mind, you know, that you just need to give that credit to God and not keep taking that credit for yourself. Quit patting yourself on the back for things that you do for other people and give that credit to God. And that wasn't so hard. And that took up a big chunk of my day that I didn't know what I was going to do with, you know. I've just grown to have a really good relationship with my higher power. I heard somebody in a meeting one time say, I had to take God out of the box. And I was like, what the heck are they talking about? Take God out of the box, you know? And I thought about that, and I realized what they meant was is that they had all these restrictions on God and had limited God to their imagination. God's power was only limited to their imagination. And that's what I was doing, you know. In other words, God wasn't any better than me. I needed to tell God what to do, when to do it, how to do it, whether I approved or not of what He did. You know, I was limited God to my own imagination, to my own, as far as I could think, you know. And it wasn't working for me. And that was really cool when I let God out of the box. I let God be bigger and let Him consume everything and be part of everything. And everything's just the way it's supposed to be. And I got to admit, you know, there's some things I'm not supposed to do. And there's some things other people do that they're not supposed to do. But that's not for me to judge anymore. God's in charge of that, you know. I didn't think I was supposed to go to the penitentiary, but evidently I was. I didn't think the judge was supposed to threaten me with a life sentence, but evidently he did, you know. And all that stuff was good for me. And I can see that now. I can see that, and you know, it's the most amazing thing. Man, I used to be paranoid of the cops. I've been pulled over 5 times in the past 3 years, and I've been let go 3 times, got a warning ticket twice. I went to prison when they pulled me over before for 5 or 10 years, you know. That was like, it just makes me laugh, you know. And they're nice to me. Yes, Mr. Lampson. Yes, Mr. Lampson. We know Mr. Lampson. Have a good day, you know. I'm like, wow. I'm not even scared, you know. I can kick back and talk to them for a while, you know. No problem. And that's really neat. You know, that's just an example of how my life has changed. And you know, my attitude needed to be completely reconstructed. I had such a lousy attitude, and I had to redo. I had to let God take care of it. I had to let Him reconstruct my whole attitude. I forgot what I was going to say. I'm glad for it. I'm really happy for, you know, that that I got a life now that means something. And I got friends that mean something. You know, I never had any friends before that liked me for anything other than the alcohol or the drugs they could get from me, you know. And to tell you the truth, I didn't like anybody else either. If I had anything to do with somebody, it was because I was going to get something out of them. If I was nice to them, it was because I was going to hit them up for something real big later, you know. I already had, you know, I was just rotten. And it's just much easier to trust God and clean house and be a service to others. It's a much easier life, and it's making me happy today. And I don't hate anybody, even people that do nasty things to me. I don't hate them. I still love them, and I pray for them. My sponsor's making sure of that, you know. And I love you guys. Nobody's told you today that they love you. I love you. And I wanted to tell you that this is my home group. I have 3 home groups. Whitney was my first home group. Meridian was my second home group. And West is my third home group. And they're all still my home groups. I go to all of them. I probably do 8 or 10 meetings a week. You know, I go to all. I don't come here as often as I would like to. But my sponsor tells me, you know, I did that for safety precautions because I'm really sick. I don't know when one of these groups is going to kick me out. But my sponsor tells me, he says, if there's something about your home group that you don't like, he says, don't go to somebody else's home group and screw it up too. So I've got 3 home groups that keep me safe. You know? Anyway, I'm glad to be here, and that's my story for right now. It might change later. I'm sure it will, but I'm sticking to it. Thank you.
Awesome. Bye.
Thank you, Sam. That was awesome. Yeah, every time I go to Whitney, Sam's there. Every time I go to the door, he's right there in the door. I don't go to the West like I should. I can get back over there with your sponsor. He's a good man, got many, many years. Yeah. Anybody can keep you on the straight down, it would be lovely. Appreciate you being here. No more birthday celebrations. Tracy, would you hand out the monkey keys?
The Meridian Group chooses to use the CHIP system to recognize. I'm sorry, I'm Tracy. I'm an alcoholic. The Meridian Group chooses to use the CHIP system to recognize different lengths of sobriety. Our first CHIP is the Desire CHIP. Is there anyone here that would like to try our way of life for the next 24 hours? Okay. Is there anyone that needs to reestablish a sobriety date or return a wet one for a dry one? Is there anyone here celebrating 1 month of continued sobriety? 2 months? 3 months? 6 months? 9 months? 18 months? Is there anyone who has a yearly birthday today that would like their CHIP now? Yearly birthday celebrations are held on the last Wednesday of each month. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Grace. Please remember our 12 traditions, which states that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. With this in mind, remember everything shared here was shared in strict confidence. Do not repeat it to anyone not here tonight. If you are self-cleaning for our own efforts, please take a moment to help in your meeting room. There's a big birthday cake out there. Nobody leaves unless they have a piece of cake before they go. So let's pray and we'll figure out and smoke one. Close and use the mat. Thank you once more, Sam. Appreciate you being here and being of service to us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Jim, would you lead us out tonight?
Who's Father?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
He's coming back at 14
more days. And more weeks.